Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Coming up in this edition of the TV Black Box, a worker at Channel 10 tests positive to COVID-19, but has the network done enough to protect its staff? Twitter claims another victim as a high-profile TV star is attacked viciously. And first reactions to the big new battle for eyeballs as 7 and 10 unleash their big new shows. Welcome to the podcast where people in the TV industry get their news. TV Black Box is about to start.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is TV Black Box, bringing you the inside goss from the TV industry.
And it's a very big hello to David Robinson, who joins the TV Black Box team as a permanent member. Hello, Robbo.
Hooray!
Yay! Hello.
I thought this was a reboot of the And Robin Robbo show. Is this?
Don't bring up that. Yeah. Unfair words.
I don't remember that at all.
Do not mention that show.
Sorry. Oops. Thanks for having me, guys. Looking forward to be part of the team.
Robbo's on the Gold Coast. Mulk joins us from Sydney. Hello, Mulky.
Coming to you live from the Met Gala, Rob. And let me tell you, the dress I've chosen to wear is amazing.
Your front really is highlights lovely, my doll. Cleavage.
It does. Aaron Ryan joins us from Perth. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, gorgeous people. Lovely to have Robbo on board. I'm very excited. The gays are taking over the world.
Whoa. People didn't know. That was going to be a big reveal in episode 7.
All right. And all the way from Florida is Sarah Monahan. Hello, Sarah.
Someone had to bring the vagina to the group.
I thought I did that.
Other than me, Sarah.
Well, a pussy and a vagina, two different things.
Okay. And of course, I'm Rob McKnight coming to you from the Gold Coast. Let's get into the stories of the week. And as COVID-19 cases soar in New South Wales, a worker at Channel 10's Pyrmont office has tested positive to the virus. As exclusively revealed on TV Black Box, a note sent out by the National Health and Wellbeing Manager advises anyone considered a close contact to stay at home immediately. It's understood Studio 10 has the most number of staff affected, including host Tristan McManus. In further news, Kevin Perry reveals the 10 Network has so far failed to implement a rapid COVID testing protocol for essential employees working inside its Sydney studio facility and has instead been advising staff that if they have symptoms, they should attend a public testing service. Robbo, we've both worked in this building and that cafe next door has gone. The Studio 4 cafe has gone. 10 reinstated their internal cafe. There's not a lot of coffee options, so a lot of people would have gone through that internal cafe, and it was the barista who has COVID.
Well, yeah, you could imagine that all of those people really want their coffees. It's much easier to go there. There is a coffee shop still open for takeaways about halfway up a street there across from the IGA. But, you know, TV people are precious people and they can't be forced to walk 20 metres. So they've implemented this. It's quite a small space really up there if you get down to the funnel end of where they put the cafe that where it used to be one as well. I would assume that the majority of that building should be considered a close contact. And because it's such a small area, I can't imagine there was a lot of social distancing because who's policing it?
And that's such a massive problem, isn't it, Robbo? Because it has a huge impact on a place that is now the production hub for most of 10's news. Obviously, Studio 10 at that time of day that they're talking about will have been the primary concern. But because, you know, editors, producers, even journalists are in that building from Sparrow's Fart, a lot of people will have possibly been in contact with someone who has been exposed. And I'm actually quite amazed at not at Kevin's great reporting, but at his reporting that that 10 haven't come up with any kind of standard protocol, people are in and out, right? Like, it's an amazing thing to hear that Foxtel have got, you know, their process in place. You've got to go up to a certain floor to get tested or you don't get into the rest of the building. 7 have everyday testing, you know, 9 headed in the same path. I think it's an amazing, situation in September 2021 that one of our major news services doesn't have a protocol in place to deal with a way to keep all of its staff as protected as they can from something like the coronavirus, which has been, like, it didn't start last week. We've had this going around Australia and the world, I appreciate, but for around Australia for at least sort of 12, 18 months.
I find this absolutely bizarre. How a network can gamble like this? Was it a budget decision? And what a strange budget decision that, because long term, if they're having to get a lot of freelancers in to cover shifts, that's going to cost them a lot of money. And it also means you've really got no control. This, I just can't fathom why they're not doing this rapid testing. They're leaving so much to chance.
And if somebody gets really sick and dies, is it then on the network because they weren't providing protections for their employees?
I absolutely hope that it is not a budgetary decision that has meant that this is the way they're dealing with it, because that is diabolical.
I don't want to start that rumour. Saying that, Mark.
It's all supposition, I acknowledge. I'm just saying I hope it's not that.
Without getting too political here, do you think this is also how, you know, the way New South Wales is going to respond to a crisis like this, or, you know, how COVID affects New South Wales and Gladys Berejiklian's way that New South Wales has responded is going to be different to another state? So if this happened, what I'm saying is if this happened in Queensland or happened in South Australia or WA, this would be a completely different way of responding to something. But
no, because Seven's not doing it that way, right? Like, Seven's very...
And also they're setting the terms for the whole network. So what they implement in Sydney is what they implement in Melbourne and Brisbane. And Melbourne and Sydney are the two big hubs for daily programming. I don't understand this at all, but we just have to see how this plays out. And thank you to the people who tipped us off and have given us information, because this is a story that needs to be told. And in more COVID news, Sunrise has reportedly become the first television program in Australia to implement a mandatory vaccine policy after an employee tested positive in their Martin Place studios last month. As reported by The Australian, this is particularly relevant for the show's freelance hair and makeup staff who may work at other networks and are in contact with a wide range of people. I've got to say, Sarah, they've already had one COVID scare. This seems fair enough to me. So Natalie Barr, David Kosh, Edwina Bartholomew, Mark Beretta and Michael Pell, the executive producer, are laying down the law saying unless you've had the vaccine, you can't work here. Eddie's pregnant. Koshy said, I'm 65 years old. I'm getting older. I am in a danger zone. I absolutely think this is fair enough. What do you think?
I think so too, because they actually did do the poll among the staff, and the staff overwhelmingly came out. It was like 3/4 said yes, absolutely.
74% or something, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if they voted for it and they feel safer doing that, then absolutely. And people, you know, hair and makeup, you're in someone's face.
Yeah.
Close breathing on someone's face for an extended period of time. Like, I can do my makeup at home in like legit 4 minutes, and I'll go in a studio and it takes 45. And I'm like, am I that ugly or are you just really taking your time? But I mean, you're extended breathing in someone's face, and then you've got hair, and it's always a small closed room where everybody gossips. So, I mean, absolutely, if you're in there, you should be vaccinated. I'm wondering if they will then spread out to other staff. But, I mean, at the moment, hair and makeup is probably the most in your face, and everyone else can, you know, keep their 6-foot distance.
Like we were saying before, you've got to protect your product. And if you lose your main, you know, cogs of your factory, you're stuffed. So I think this is a really good idea. And if people don't want to be vaxxed that work in those kind of close industries, that's their choice. But then I think it's unfair for them to be still think they can be considered for employment, especially if you're in hair and makeup, like Sarah said, you're very up close. This is just the way of the world now. And I think this is a really good thing. Protect your product.
Absolutely.
Don't just hope for the best like the other blokes.
Yeah. Well, Twitter has claimed another victim after ABC presenter Lisa Miller deactivated her account. With over 54,000 followers, Miller has been on the receiving end of some truly vile and distressing personal attacks. That's according to her News Breakfast co-host, Michael Rowland. Now, Mock, it's an unfortunate side of fame and success. Is this something she has to cop on the chin, or do trolls need to be held accountable?
Firstly, Twitter did nothing. People on Twitter did stuff. Horrendous people with horrendous views.
And then Twitter did nothing because they didn't do anything about it.
In part, yes, that becomes the problem. However, the sheer volume of horrendous comments and claims and abuse and all sorts of things that get thrown in just Lisa's direction in this instance is almost too hard to report, to keep up with and you know, address, because understandably, Twitter aren't going to do anything unless they're told about it, blah, blah, blah. Lee Sales has come out in the last 24 hours and written an incredible article about her experience, reflecting on Lisa's experience in the similar way, and kind of, I guess, kind of counterpointing it against the fact that as journalists who work in the political sphere particularly, they have often copped, you know, an earful, you know, statements, backhanders, all sorts of things from politicians. And for some, that's led to, you know, a series of harassing texts or phone calls or all sorts of things. And in the story that Lee outlines, you know, I forwarded, you know, one message back to the PMO and I received an apology from that minister the next day. You know, it kind of, it just got addressed. And that is in part how it needs to happen. If someone's going to be outrageous, someone gets their ass kicked and they apologise and we move on. I was really reflecting on this because I have to say, largely, my experience on Twitter has been great. And that's because I've probably curated a feed of a whole bunch of different people that I like to listen to. I try and keep it pretty broad and open. It's not just people who tell me the things that I want to hear. I like to hear some counter opinions, though there are some that I tried to hold on to for the longest time. And I just couldn't, because they just kept banging on with the same stuff that really was quite offensive, honestly. I understand absolutely where Lisa and Lee and Patricia Cavalis and particularly female journalists on Twitter come from, because I've seen the horrendous stuff that is from anonymous accounts, that is from named accounts, actual people. You know, it's saying horrendous things to people. And
but
I was thinking
the majority are anonymous accounts. Let's be clear on this. Yes,
sure.
Some people do it with their real name.
I can't give you the stats. There's no – it's only anecdotal evidence that says that the majority are anything. The challenge in this is that up until Twitter came about, all of us normal, boring humans didn't have a chance to engage with journalists, let alone stars and all of the reasons that you might want to be a part of Twitter. It is a phenomenal tool for journalists because it does allow you to connect into breaking news, hear and see, and even report, you know, the latest developments on what's happening. Mm. The benefits, and it has become the detraction of Twitter is that it's allowed me, as an example, to be able to speak directly to people who run shows, people who are journalists on programs, stars, all of those sorts of things. Whether they choose to respond is up to them. And I'm not, I don't,
well, that's
I'm not
how
doing
we got to know
stuff.
Each other.
That's right. I'm not throwing any, you know, horrible statements at them. However, it does provide people that platform to be able to do so. It's outrageous that anybody thinks that it is okay to speak to someone that they do not know in the way that they have been. I think it is horrendous that people have been saying some of the vile things that they have, particularly to female journalists, sexual innuendo, sexual statements, suggesting that they are supporters of this party and they are tied to whatever, whatever. Mate, it is outrageous that this has been the experience of anybody on this planet.
Now, a couple of things on this. Someone, building off what you said, Malk, someone tweeted me when we broke the news, Leo Puglisi broke the news. We put it out there through TV Black Box as well, crediting him. But someone tweeted me saying anyone with a blue tick should not have the right to block anyone and should have to accept anything that's said about them.
That's bullshit.
I pushed back a bit against that big time, as you can imagine. But secondly, just in the last 24 hours, so the Australian's Sophie Ellsworth, She posted a story about Lee Sales, and she said, high-profile journalists, including Lee Sales, have voiced their concerns about Twitter's relevance to the industry, with an increasing number of media professionals opting to abandon the site altogether. I replied to that, just put a comment in, saying Twitter is certainly not reflective of mainstream Australia. The things that become big issues here are irrelevant to most Aussies. Then the pile-on started. So people who aren't in my sphere, aren't in my world, don't follow me, all started attacking me about old media, you know, all this kind of stuff, tried to attack what I do, went looking at my profile, and instead of having a discussion about what I had said, one, told me I was wrong, which is fine,
sure,
but then started trying to attack me. And, you know, that stuff, when it keeps coming, can get people down. Now, I try to stand up to bullies and won't, you know, like I'm pretty forthright in my responses to them. I don't get personal, but I will talk to them about the issues. But even when you use logic and reason with these people, they don't want to hear that. They're all from anonymous accounts. They all just want to attack because you disagree with their viewpoint on life. And I think this is the danger of Twitter. It's extremist views. There are extremist views that allow people to anonymously attack anyone who disagrees with them. And I'll put it out there. Mike Carton.
It's not just Twitter,
I said something innocuous in a reply to one of his tweets and got the block. That is his right. But there are people out there who don't want to engage in any level of conversation. They do want the echo chamber. And Aaron, I do think Twitter needs real names. You want to make a statement, you have to be held accountable. I think this is really important going forward. If you want to say something, if you want to mock someone, attack them, you need to be held accountable.
Absolutely, for sure. I mean, my handle is at Aaron Perth on Twitter, and I can honestly say that I've never once sent a message from some anonymous account to anybody. I wanted to add something. You know, you think, oh, we're having an intelligent conversation about this, but I really just got to take the low bar on this and say that some people out there are just weak pieces of shit that hide behind a keyboard, and for just a moment, they think that they are strong and powerful and tough, sending out vile and disgusting comments while actually being weak and pathetic and hiding behind some anonymous account. It's fair criticism of someone in the media, you know, written by someone that is prepared to stand up and write it from a verified account with their real name and email address. You know, it's game on in the public eye, especially for those that are on a large platform giving their opinion. They should expect some opposition and an opposing point of view. But to Lisa Miller, all I'll say is deactivate your account for a while, but do not lose one night of sleep over these weak, faceless pieces of garbage.
With dudes, it's different because you guys get disagreements and people call you a dickhead and all that. But when you're a woman, it gets doubled down because not only do people call you an idiot, but then they start sending rape threats and, like, you know, there's all this misogyny and stuff. And it's so sexual, and it's just, it's ridiculous. And yes, I agree. Like, I get that Twitter is supposed to, like, they have anonymous in case, you know, you're a whistleblower or whatever. But I think that absolutely everyone should be verified because, number one, it stops people impersonating people. It stops trolling. It stops all kinds of shit. And Twitter just needs to start, like...
It won't, though. It won't, though. As we discussed, while a large proportion, sure, are anonymous accounts, there's a whole bunch of people who have their names, where they work or whatever, you know, views not whatever.
Yes, but then they can be held accountable.
But no, they're not, Rob, and that's the problem. They're not held accountable.
But they are, because if their employer finds out what they're saying and doing, that employer has a choice whether to keep employing them. When they're doing it from a fake account, and you know
what? No, but the employer doesn't know. See, this is the problem. The employer doesn't own their personal
time. Well,
that's
a whole different argument, but you could argue is reflective of an employer's values. If they're threatening rape against someone, that employer has to make a decision whether they want that person working for them.
I'm not saying that they are that their views are valid and that they should be able to say this. Like, I'm not in that situation.
No, I know.
All I'm suggesting is that if you're, you know, Joe Public that works at kebab shop or, you know, does traffic control or those sorts of things, if you say something horrendous to someone at whatever level, your employer doesn't have a right to make a claim over you about what you can and can't do.
It's a whole different argument, to be honest. We're going on a tangent, but all I would say is that real names will make people think twice. And yes, there may still be an element of that, Mulk, but I can tell you, I feel, from my anecdotal evidence, the abuse on Twitter would drop by about 80%, the vile abuse.
I agree.
I'm all for a difference of opinion.
If people are verified, it reduces the anonymous accounts, which make up a large portion of this. Look, correct. It is outrageous that anybody faces any of this down.
All right. Seven News reporter and former Bachelorette Georgia Love has been demoted to a production role after sparking controversy over an Instagram post. Georgia posted a video of a cat sitting inside an Asian restaurant with the caption, "Shop attendant or lunch?" She later deleted the video, issuing an apology, saying that it was meant to be a joke about an animal being in a restaurant at lunch service time, not an insinuation about the type of restaurant. Another post of Georgia's also resurfaced last week with a similar joke made in 2013. She has since been dumped as an ambassador for Chadstone Shopping Centre in Melbourne following the controversy. So, Sarah, did the punishment fit the crime here?
So I was reading to my husband the rundown of what we were going to be talking about, and I told him this, and I showed him the picture, and he said, "But I ate cat in China." So he was like, you know, is it bad taste? Is it casual racism? You're not allowed to... I mean, I get that it's casual racism, but also it's like you can't make a joke about anything anymore. And if it's true because you eat cats in China, I don't know.
Look, it's a fair point. And look, none of us are Asian. None of us have had this stereotype thrust against us. But you know what? How far do the Twitter mob want to go when claiming blood? Now, she's been outed over this, right? And she's apologised and seen the error of her ways, even if it was unintended and she wasn't trying to be racist. Let's give her the benefit of the doubt here. The fact is it still came across racist, okay? So if she said, you're all fucked, there's no problem here, then fine, keep the campaign going. But there's this mentality that as soon as someone does something wrong, we go after them and we will not stop until they're deplatformed, lose their job.
I think there's a bit more to it than that for this particular person. So Georgia Love has built a brand out of, you know, not being bullied and standing up for everyone and being this, you know, this shining light in respect to those kind of ideas or those ideals, rather. This is tone deaf.
Sure.
This was stupid, and if you're going to project yourself as a certain kind of personality in the world, and I have no doubt Georgia Love is lovely, I've met her many times, worked with her, she's lovely, but if you're going to project that kind of image, then you know, you fall from a greater height than other people who are putting these jokes in there. There is no other way to interpret that joke.
And okay? Especially so when not only are you a journalist with a profile, but you've also used that to build your profile by becoming the Bachelorette. So it stretches beyond the fact that she's, air quotes, only a journalist.
Mm.
Georgia's been a great journalist, done some great jobs before. But because she parlayed into other kind of celebrity to build and grow that opportunity, it makes her an even more high-profile target. This is what I was getting at before with my Koshy comment. If Koshy... was to say something in a similar kind of vein, you would expect huge blowback compared to General Joe on the street, right? General Joe on the street can have an offensive position. You say you're an idiot, people don't like him, whatever, whatever, we get on with their lives. The amount of amplification of your message is why, in part, this is such a horrendous thing for Georgia to have done.
But Mark, if it was Koshy wouldn't be pulled off air. It's also I really think that he'd do a
guess
massive Koshy's apology.
Joke book number three did have probably a gag like this in it.
I'm sure it did. But I just think if networks can get all high and mighty about what they consider to be morally corrupt and things like that.
Yep.
But weirdly, it's so weird that if you make a lot of money or you're a big star for the network, the punishments alter. So she's been pulled off, put onto the production desk. If it was Koshy, he would be back on there the next day delivering
an apology.
Big apology.
Mea culpa.
And then he'd be back on Wednesday's program and Thursday's program. He would never be suspended off air.
And it's, look, Koshy hasn't said anything like this.
No, of course not.
Not that I can recall.
He's a great man.
I'm not trying to cast aspersions over Koshy. He was just simply an example.
No,
I guess
we know
in part you're right. It is the value you are to the network that kind of slices and dices what the punishment is. However, we do also live in, you know, 2021, a post-Me Too scenario, you know, where everything and everyone is kind of almost, we've swung the other way, where we are hyper aware of what everybody says. And I reckon that if somebody with a profile akin to Koshy or whatever was to say something like Georgia did, I don't reckon it would be as simple as a mea culpa and we get on with the show. Not nowadays.
I think there would be a, I think the network would sit there and consider how is, there's the Twitter reaction, there's the newspaper reaction, and then there's the viewer reaction.
Yeah, did viewers, anybody notice? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, do viewers care about what was said as much as Twitter? If we take Koshy off, and we're using him as the example, Koshy.
But he's a big star, big star.
Big star.
Eddie McGuire.
If we take Koshy off, will it cost us viewers? Or if we leave him on, will it cost us more viewers? So there is an analysis that needs to go on, and it is a business decision.
That's right. Aaron, so it's not a moral decision. It's not like
sometimes,
you know,
morals play in it.
Oh, absolutely.
ABC
but at the
America
end of the day,
took
though,
Roseanne off air because they made a moral decision. They took a big risk and cancelled that show. So
it's not going to happen here in Australia. Yeah, they're not going to remove someone who's on that level.
Before we spend too much time on this, Aaron, I want one last question. Can Georgia recover from this and get back on air?
They can recover if the public perception changes. I feel like us as humans, aren't we supposed to understand that everyone makes a mistake, but it's what you learn from that mistake and what is it that you do about that mistake that actually counts?
Yes.
So in this particular case, if I was seven and this is... I would have thought, and I just wrote something down, it's only a couple of lines, but what my response would have been from Seven, and that is that the views and comments made by employee Georgia Love do not reflect the views or values of the Seven Network. In this case, Georgia has shown deep regret for the comments and has opted to publicly apologise for these comments on the platform it was posted on. As this is out of character for Georgia, and she now accepts full responsibility and understands the nature of why this post may be considered offensive, we will not impose any restrictions or penalty for her employment.
The only issue you've got there is you say it's out of character, but there's a post from 8 years ago that sort of says it's in character. That would be... I think that's good spin. I love a good bit of spin and I like that. The problem is it came off another...
But a comment from 8 years ago does not suggest who you are. So
sure.
She's made what?
But you can't just say that. You've got to look at how these things will be received when you put a statement like that out there. Your statement was perfect until that point because that allowed people to poke a hole. They have an example. Now, look, I like Georgia, by the way. I'm not picking on Georgia, but... My point is, when you release a statement, when you're media managing things like that, you have to look at every word you say and how are people going to fight against that. When you say this is out of character, the Twitterati will say, no.
They'll dig back 8 years.
We've got something from 8 years.
I'm just wondering, what we're teaching our teenagers, that's all. I was at the bigger point. You're 15 years old. You know, you're going to make mistakes in your life, but we're trying to teach people what will you learn and what's going to happen next after that mistake. But right now, because we're in that hyper, someone said like the hyperbole of all of this going on, it's just, oh, no, take you off air. Slap down. Yeah. We're going to sack this person. We're going to it's just, hang on.
Let's be honest. The timing wasn't great for her because Seven have come off a couple of racist incidents. The most recent one being the tweet where it said three black men scored the goal or something like that. I can't remember the tweet exactly, but it was a whole controversy that instead of talking about their skills, talked about their skin color. It was very, very silly. But look,
this indeed is the challenge to round this out, Rob. I was born last millennium. When I made mistakes, I maybe had to front up to some people and apologise, and that was it.
Yeah.
If they remembered it, they remembered it. It was a rare mistake made by anybody. It had to get into the paper for anybody to care about it, right?
Yeah.
Nowadays, you make a mistake. The internet is forever. Doesn't matter what it is, what you did, how you did it, even if it's an out-of-context statement back then, and sure, the last comment from Georgia may have been 8 years ago, The problem is that there's now been a second one that has been publicly connected. And even if you've been the sweetest angel in between, two starts to form a pattern.
Yep.
That's what it says. And if we didn't know about the first one or couldn't remember the first one, it would be an isolated incident and she would have to apologise and we'd all be getting on with our life and not even talking about it.
Agreed.
The biggest problem for Georgia is she makes a lot of jokes on social media and not everything's going to hit, and sometimes you get it really, really wrong, and she got it really, really wrong, and now she's paying the price. I hope she can come back. But now it's time for Hatches and Dispatches with Sarah.
Thanks, Rob. Former television host Andrew O'Keefe is facing new charges of domestic violence. It's alleged he spat at and scratched a woman during an argument at a home in Point Piper last week. Channel 9's The Block is moving to country Victoria next year, according to the Herald Sun. According to the paper, the show is shelling out millions, moving to a 79-acre property at Gisborne South. TEN's network director of news content, Ross Dagan, has received a call-up to the big leagues with a promotion to parent company ViacomCBS in New York. Dagan takes on a newly created senior leadership role responsible for reimagining and aligning the news operations and engineering functions across CBS news and stations. Nine has announced a new daily podcast called Nine News Lunch Podcast. The 10-minute national news bulletin is presented by Nine radio journalists Amy Meehan and Natalie Peters, who lead the newsrooms of 2GB, 3AW, 4BC and 6PR, and utilizes the resources of Nine News journalists across the country. It will be available every day from 12:30 p.m. And that is this week's Hatches and Dispatches. Back to you, Rob.
Thank you, Sarah. In a moment, we're going to be talking ratings, not only week 37, but we're going to be talking about Sunday night's big ratings as finales went up against each other, and Monday night's ratings when brand new shows took place. As we record this, the team will hear the results for the first time. Ooh. Their instant reactions right here on TV Black Box.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's turn our attention to the ratings race for week 37. And Team Red took top honours with a 31.4 network share across the five cap cities. The Blues weren't too far behind on 28.5, while Team 10 had 17.6. The national broadcaster came home with 14.9 and SBS had 7.6. In terms of primary channels, the rankings remain the same, although 10 had a shocking Saturday night where they came sixth behind SBS and 7mate. Speaking of 7mate, it was the most popular multi-channel. While the Reds took total people, the Blues claimed the 16 to 39 and 25 to 54 demos. Aaron, it's definitely a tale of two cities here. Seven, to me, it looks like they'll win total people for the year, but Nine do look set to claim the demos.
Yeah, that's very possibly the case, depending whether you're looking at network or main channel share. So, well, actually, I do have the year-to-date figures. So the total people as a network, seven's in front, 39.3 to 9 on 37.2. In 25 to 54, though, as you say, 9 are in front, 37% to 35.1, but 7 are in front in 16 to 39, and 9 are in front in under 50, so it's kind of a little bit all over the place. But on the main channel shares, 7 is actually in front, which they may even win the year on the main channel, 27.1 to 26.8 for 9. But 9 are comfortably ahead on the main channel in 25 to 54, 16 to 39, and under 50s.
Mulk, this week we got the first official VOZ report. What did we learn?
Yeah, well, look, we've been getting VOZ for a little bit, but what we managed to pick up this week was the first total TV consolidated 7 daily program rankings, which is an everyday report that we get that will tell us how last week's overnights have been added to when we add in the consolidated 7 viewing figures and the BVOD figures since that date. So it's a whole bunch of extra figures. The key thing that we learned, and I think we kind of knew was bubbling along anyway, is that drama absolutely benefits from catch-up. Way more people are using drama either as a binge opportunity or as a chance to go, I'll watch the big, shiny, flashy reality show and then I'll catch up on drama when it suits me, but ideally in those 7 days. And the most critical, I guess, way to point that out is the Newsreader's episode from Sunday previous went up a whopping 54%.
Wow.
It cracked 1 million viewers by the time you add in the Con 7 and the BVOD viewing to its overnight figures, which were about 440, if I think from memory. That's just 5 City Metro. It also adds in regional. Sorry, I do need to make sure that's clear. So it's 5 City Metro plus regional plus catch up, Con 7 plus BVOD. Pushed it right over the top. Like, that's a huge increase and hopefully gives a bit of heart to drama, you know, makers, writers, producers, actors, that there is still a market for their content. It's just not necessarily going to pick up the big buzzy, we're all watching it live over, you know, the overnights like we used to.
Indeed. All right. Well, this week we saw the end of some big shows and the start of some big new ones. On Sunday night, The Voice on 7 ended with a high of 1.383 million watching the winner announced and 1.292 million watching the main show. The Block came in second on 952,000, and Ten's gamble of running the Survivor finale in such a competitive slot kept Ten in the game to some extent. The winner portion had 923,000 and the main show 785,000. The next big battle was Monday night with SAS Australia and The Masked Singer entering the fray, but we'll get to that in a moment. Aaron, you called it the worst programming decision of the year when 10 moved Survivor up against The Voice finale. Do you stand by that assertion?
I actually do stand by the decision, and I'll tell you why. It did perform fairly strongly. You can roll the tape if you like, but I never suggested that because The Voice was on, it was going to attract 300,000 viewers and do terribly. Up against The Voice, it usually does about 700,000, and it has performed very strongly this season. So I didn't think it was going to do less than 700,000. My main argument was that the Tuesday slot gave it free space, and that's the words I used. It gave 10 and advertisers the opportunity to, as I said, what I called free space. Holy moly on 7 completely sunk to almost like zero viewers. I think it was like 200,000. It was terrible. 10 would have completely owned the night, probably had more viewers than Sunday, perhaps even won the night on the primary channel, and then gave the winner the opportunity the next day to have free space, you know, with all the publicity. Moving it to Sunday created unnecessary clutter, and I think was just silly. And just because it did well, it doesn't change the fact that it was a dumb decision.
But they had a decent share, not spectacular, but not a failure. There's an argument that if they had put something else on a Sunday, their share could have been, you know, their primary channel share could have been less than 10%.
Yeah, but that's what they would have given up. That's fine. They definitely would have had a much, much lower share. But the benefit of being on Tuesday night is having a huge night. Everyone's watching Australian Survivor. Everyone's talking about it the next day. Everyone's talking about the winner. But it was all a lot of clutter. The next morning, it's who won The Voice, who the Block, you know, Master Ensuite, what happened there, and then Australian Survivor. It was too much clutter. But it probably did for 10 what they wanted to do, which was to be a platform for the week, which had The Masked Singer coming on the next day, had Making It on Wednesday and Thursday, Gogglebox, you know, all that sort of stuff. So
talk about your sacrificial lambs, though. Like, I agree that they had the clear air on Tuesday night and would have made sense to play it out. Now, Tuesday's audiences aren't usually as big as Sunday's. We buy that. I think that the nature of this season of Survivor would have meant they almost would have had a lay-down Mazaire win. It would have been one of their biggest outcomes for the year. And this is, of course, hypothetical. We don't know this. In the same way, I'd also say that they wouldn't have just laid down by having it on Tuesday. We don't know what they could have programmed there that would have meant that it wasn't competitive. I agree, it probably wouldn't have got the 780, 900 something that it...
They would have just put a movie on.
They could have put anything on, right? Anything. It wouldn't have got Survivor numbers. It wouldn't have been them just capitulating, though. I can absolutely promise you that. The challenge in the midst of all of this is that they have wasted one of their best seasons of Survivor and one of their best shows this year by moving it into a place where it came third, and we all predicted that. The only reason the winner announced got above 900 was because The Block and The Voice had both finished by then.
Right. That's good to know.
If it had finished at the same time, it was screwed. And that's the problem. If it had just run against The Block on Tuesday night, right, The Block Tuesday's a bit of something something, right? Who cares? If you'd put the Survivor finale on and seen Haley and George battle it out, as it was, 10 made the massive misstep of editing down George's speech at the final jury. And this was Jonathan LaPaglia announcing this on Twitter. He said, it's such a shame they cut down George's speech because it was so good in person. So, I mean, he came second, no question. But if it was so good, why did they cut it out? Maybe they were wanting to kill it for time and do all of the rest of it. It did already run for 2 hours. But the jury is where it all happens. Cut some of the other shit out that started. They were walking in slow motion for 8 minutes at the start of the episode. Fuck that off. Right? Walk at double speed so we can hear what George had to say. It goes up for mine as one of the worst programming decisions of 2021, and no one has been able to give me a worse one yet.
You and Aaron are in agreement. Let me bring you the results from last night. We are recording this on Tuesday morning. We had the big The Masked Singer happening and SAS Australia launch up against The Block.
Yep.
Well, Seven News took 1 and 2 spots.
Nine News took
3 and 4.
Boo, who
and
cares?
Coming in fifth, the number one entertainment show of the night, was The Block on 864,000 on Channel 9. Then it was Current Affair, ABC News. Then The Masked Singer. Launch reveal. So yep. Only The Block where they took the mask
sure,
off.
Sure, the last 5 minutes.
Did 760,000. Then we had Home and Away. SAS Australia did 647,000. And the whole episode, minus the reveal of The Masked Singer, did 642,000.
So smidge under SAS.
A mixed bag there.
Can I just say something really quickly about this? Mm-hmm. There's something really lovely that makes me feel good still about Australia, which sometimes is hard to do, that Home and Away is still in the top ratings. There's something simple and beautiful and wonderful about that.
I just heard that. Yeah, I love
that. That means that we've still got our heart.
It's had a resurgence.
Only since the Olympics has it been above the 600s, and that's really important because for the first half, two-thirds of the year, it was doing fours and fives. So it's really made a comeback post-season.
And I hear these numbers and think about 100 years ago when I was on television that if you rated below a million, you were losing your TV show.
Long time ago, Sarah. Let me bring you the shares. Jesus. Let me bring you the shares because Seven won the night on 27.3. Nine was just behind on a flat 27%. Network 10 did pretty well on 21.1% ahead of the ABC on 17.4%. I think everyone's got a reason to be happy last night. The Channel 9 will be very happy about The Block winning the number one entertainment show. 10's got good reason to smile. Masked Singer was only just behind SAS Australia, but when you include the launch reveal, it got some good numbers.
Yep.
SAS Australia, I think, is probably a bit soft on 647,000, but we'll see where that goes.
I reckon that'll be the best we see from SAS Australia this year.
Really?
Yeah, I think that and I'll talk about this a little more in the binge box. This is not the first season. They've really amped it up and they've made it more aggressive and it is far more in your face. And it's while it had to establish its credentials for season one, season two they've just gone harder. And I don't think that that's to its benefit.
Too much, is it? I haven't seen it yet.
I've seen the first three and it's brutal. Like it is, they are in those celebrities' faces in a way that I don't think they were last year.
Right.
And that's going to be a tough one for it. The Masked Singer is a firework again for 10. It'll happen, fizz, and then it'll leave. So that will be, it's good that it got some decent numbers. I don't know if it'll get much bigger. Probably it will because it built tapers towards the end. The only challenge for that format is that we've all worked out who it is by the time we get to the final episode. I heard some great guesses last night. Kerri-Anne Kennelly. Of course, Charlotte Crosby, Emma
Shiano.
But you've
got to be careful because if you think it's Kerri-Anne Kennelly, it could be Gina Riley.
It very well could be.
Kerri-Anne Kennelly.
Yes, mate.
Bring her back. That's one for the Gen Xers and above.
Yes.
And look, I think
great
that
to be with me.
The Block is now in a position to be, in number one in the slot. And even though it will taper across the week, it will have its struggles. But now that it's got clear air, nothing will beat it on Sunday nights. It'll be... Nine's juggernaut again.
Aaron, I'll give you a chance to jump in because I know you love your ratings. Your first thoughts?
Look, if I really had to guess, I was going to go with pretty much everyone was going to get 700,000. I thought it was going to be a fairly competitive night. Look, I was also going to talk about SAS and the Binge Box too. It actually is my favourite show of the year. I love SAS. It's brutal stuff, but I don't think it's ever going to attract this 1.2, 1.3 million audience because it is a very hard watch. Like, it's actually, I mean, I get quite emotional watching the show. It's very hard to watch people either physically hurting each other, people being yelled at in their face, being called C's and F's. It's actually, yeah, it's really hard.
Only if you watch the 7+ version.
It sounds like a production meeting in any TV show.
But the only thing that can go from this, I agree with Malk here.
The real military.
The only place it could go for, say, season three is The Hunger Games. We won't be happy unless people are dying on screen. And it's a bit of a funny joke, but at the same time, no one laughed. But also, at the same time,
it wasn't a funny joke.
But at the same time, like what Aaron is saying, you've got to go to these extremes. How much more extreme can you go with a show like this, which means its shelf life is incredibly
short. It's always the diminishing returns problem. When you come in with the next season.
Unless you kill someone.
How can we make it bigger and better and more interesting and blah, blah, blah?
Let's kill a celebrity.
You don't need to up the ante with the show. The thing is, It's with each different celebrity on how it affects them. So it's a completely different season. I mean, watching someone like Bonnie Anderson, I mean, people will see in episode three, there's a whole water thing. And what you see and how that transforms her life and hearing about her backstory, it doesn't matter that we may have seen something like that last season because it's how it affected Bonnie Anderson. So I actually think it feels like it's completely new in that regard. The only other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, the block, I mean, that is the best improver of the year. I definitely had a shaky start. It had the whole cheating scandal and it's gone up into that 900,000 sort of one.
AKA the Block Olympics.
Yeah. So it's actually going really well. So you expect that to keep going now with that 800,000, 900,000 type figures. So I think if anyone kind of missed out, it was probably The Masked Singer. I would have expected probably maybe a little bit more from that. It's only a 3-week event. And a lot of people are still in lockdown and people are at home.
That's on par with last year though, isn't it?
Yep. Again, diminishing returns. It's season three, you know, like the producers have made a big note of jumping up and down and saying, look, we were amazed at the talent that we could get because nobody had anything on. So we were able to get, like, how Vinnie Jones snuck into the country is beyond me, but well done to him.
Well, he didn't Instagram it, unlike other contestants.
That's right. He just appeared in the country. No one really knew. No one really knew who he was. I think that's the problem for all of it. I mean, The Block is on season 17. It's gone through diminishing returns twice. And had to go and rebuild and go and rebuild, pardon the puns. I think this is our ongoing issue that TV Black Box has with the TV industry, and that is that we just want fresh ideas. Let's not roll out tired, you know, formats that we've seen before or slight variations on a theme. Let's give us new stuff. Let's roll the dice and let's get executives both pumped and ready to back risking new things.
Absolutely.
Hey, next week, I think for the run sheet that we actually, because now we've got these total TV figures, it will be interesting to see next week what happens to that. My guessing is that SAS will improve the most in terms of catch up and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, big calls.
No, well, because I think most people, from a live point of view, want to watch The Mask because you want to know who the reveal is that night.
Yeah, you don't want to hear it before.
That's essential viewing for that night. So that I reckon The Mask will have the least of the, you know, in the total TV for pickup. Then probably The Block. Some people watch that live. They want to see the thing, but that's something that you can also catch up on. But SAS, you can watch sort of.
You can enjoy that Schadenfreude later.
Yeah.
And the problem is that The Block picked up 22% on last week's Sunday episode. So you can't say that The Block won't do anything. When it's coming in at, you know, whatever it pulls, 1 point something, and it pulls 22% more, I mean, it feeds into the fact that all of them will get a kick.
I never suggested it wasn't going to pick up more of an audience. I said most people are going to watch the Masked Singer live, which means that shows.
But they didn't. The most people didn't.
I think The Block is still going to benefit from the fact that everybody's in lockdown and they're looking at how they can make their prisons nicer.
All right. We've sort of talked a bit about what we're watching, but let's go into it a bit more in depth as we cover the TV Binge Box. And Robbo, I'll come to you first. What have you been watching?
Who?
You.
Oh, sorry. It's my first time. I didn't hear anything. I just keep this in because this is fun stuff. This is what I bring to the program, so keep that in. I'm still watching The Goldbergs. I'm watching The Newsreader and The Newsroom. And I'm also watching my show reel.
Good work.
All comedies.
Sarah, what have you been watching?
Ooh, besides YouTube, I've been watching a lot of sailing videos on YouTube this week, but on actual television. We watched a bunch of old movies because Matt gets off on playing the start of a movie and waiting to see how many seconds it takes me to guess what the movie is. And it really pisses him off when 3 seconds into the movie I can go, Office Space. And he's like, amazing. How do you do it? And I'm like, because it's traffic with Texas signs. Yeah. Anyway, so we watched Office Space, and then we went for another Mike Judd movie, which was Extract, which is Jason Bateman and Mila Kunis. We watched Oblivion with Tom Cruise, where he plays 1,000 versions of himself. And then we watched from 1977, the Kentucky Fried Movie, which is basically a bunch of skits. Some of them probably would no longer be kosher. it was very interesting. And then come to TV Land, of course. Can we all guess what Sarah watched?
NCIS.
You were up to season 10. Amazing. We did watch Known Below Deck. We did watch Money Heist. We finished that whole thing. And then I got one episode in of Billions and 9 Perfect Strangers because that's all they're giving me and I'm very sad.
Yeah, we can.
Oh, I love Perfect Strangers. What a throwback.
No, 9 Perfect Strangers. It's not Do the Dance of Joy.
Not Balky. Not Balky.
Sorry, guys.
Yes.
Okay. I've been watching The Big Bang Theory on loop, because as I do.
20-second
Mark,
grabs.
I've got to say, I have finished the first season of Kevin Can F Himself, and I'm just so into that show.
Yeah, so great.
I really want – this is on Amazon Prime Video. I want everyone to watch it. It is just great TV. Great TV. Still watching The Newsreader like everyone else. And I watched The Circle, which has been a reality TV show that I loved. I loved the English version.
Oh, loved. Hang on.
Yeah. And liked the Netflix version for the first couple of series. I do not like the current series. I think it's been badly cast. I think they've lost the understanding of what we like about The Circle. There was a good twist that I did like.
We like something about The Circle?
Sorry?
That's a play.
I didn't.
And I'm not sure that I'm going to be going back. But with the kids, we're doing Harry Potter, and we did Harry Potter 5, I think we did, on the weekend. So that was a bit of fun. Aaron, what have you been watching?
Oh, I really enjoyed Mirror Mirror. That was on 10. That was one of Mog's recommendations, I think, last week. And it was just really good. If you missed it, I'm sure it's on 10 Play, it would be. So,
yes.
You know, watch that one. Obviously, The Voice Grand Final. I don't think the right person won, but that's the great thing about taste being subjective. So someone else might have thought that Bella was the best. But I will also add, for a small exclusive for the TV Black Box, just a small one, that The Voice US, the new one with Ariana Grande as a judge, will be screened on 7 Flicks starting on the 26th of September. It's going to be fast-tracked from the US. So a little bit of information.
Yeah, cool.
Also, now, I thought about something that I talked about last week, which was Australia's Sexiest Tradie. And I mentioned it and I got a laugh and realised that people thought I tuned in for a perv. Now, I've then realised, you know, during the week that I don't think any of you guys obviously actually watched this or understood what the show was. This isn't actually a manpower show or with strippers and guys and hot air.
Oh, I know what it is. That's why I'm not watching it.
He's got some feedback. He has to explain himself.
because it was like, oh, yeah, you know, he loves Jason Momoa and he's watching all these types. But the show's actually an Australian comedy that's filmed mockumentary style, like The Office or Modern Family. So it's about a guy who's entered an Australian radio station contest for Australia's Sexiest Tradie, but this guy is definitely not a sexy hunk at all. He's more like Poida from Full Frontal. Remember that?
Oh,
Poida.
Yeah,
so he's more like that. So the first two episodes weren't so good, but the third episode, I just went ahead and watched it. It was hilarious, but it's really sort of bad Australian toilet humor, but so it may not be everyone's taste, but that was quite funny. Also, Gogglebox, I think it was just great having this back. I miss the gang. So the only thing I hate is...
I haven't watched it yet.
It's so good. It's a brilliant return.
The only thing that's annoying is, for whatever reason, it must be a rights issue. It's only on 10 Play for about 48 hours, and then it's taken off. So
it's on Lifestyle and Foxtel catch-up forever.
Oh, is it? Okay. So on 10 Play, it disappears on Saturday at about midday, and then it's gone. Also, a reminder that this Sunday is the season finale of The Newsreader, which will be good. And I said I was going to mention about SAS Australia. So I interviewed Dan Ewing, who most people remember as Heath Braxton from Home and Away.
He's also done some TV Black Box and Robin Robbo.
He has.
Yeah, he was a co-host.
But, yeah, I mean, I know what Mog said. It's brutal. I just feel to see people break through fear, anxiety and pressure and achieve something that is far beyond, like, a particular challenge or being yelled at in your face is just huge. You just see through breakthroughs in their whole life. I absolutely love the show. It's my favourite show of the year. I'm interested to see the non-celebrity version, which is coming up later. So, because we don't have that preconceived idea about what the celebrities are. You don't know who these people are with the normal one.
Well, we care.
And lastly, and this is, I'm doing a plug, which I don't normally do. Also, look out for a podcast this week with Bevan Lee and Eric Thompson, because it's the return of The Rafters, with Amazon dropping Back to the Rafters this Friday, the 17th of September. So I do a back-to-back interview with Bevan Lee and Dave Rafter himself, Eric Thompson.
Oh, awesome.
All right, Mulkey.
I'll reverse this in. I'm really torn as to whether or not I watch Back to the Rafters. I kind of felt like the series ended and everything was kind of okay, and I'm not sure that I want to catch up with them again. So it's great that there are six episodes coming on Amazon Prime Video, as Aaron said. I just don't know. It's been I've had the preview sitting in my inbox for a week, and I just haven't. Yeah. I don't know what that says. It's probably just that I'm not keen on it. Loving that Billions is back and deep into that. Gogglebox, what a welcome return. And it's taken only 14 seasons for me to convince my teenagers that Gogglebox is a show worth watching. I still haven't got across the line with my wife, but goodness gracious me, it was delightful. The only thing that I found challenging about Gogglebox was that, understandably, some of the people who are in the show live in LGAs of concern and are currently in lockdown. So, for example, Maddie and Sarah Marie can't be in the same room as their mate Jad. So they've got him, they're basically FaceTiming with him to watch TV. And the edits, they're not in it as much because the quality of the video isn't as good, which is a real shame. I get it. I'm glad they tried to include them. It sucks that the technology is kind of overcoming it. I will say that I dived into only Murders in the Building on Disney Plus. This is the new Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez.
Oh, I want to watch this.
Martin Short and Steve Martin are delightful. Selena Gomez can't act.
Hey, whoa. No, I put up with a lot on this podcast, and I won't hear of such truth bombs like that.
I'm sorry.
That is absolutely correct.
It's
50 points to Mulk. It's only taking everyone, it's still taking everyone to realize that she can't
She's
act.
She's horrendous, and particularly when she is right next to Steve Martin and Martin Short half the time, right? Those guys
cast are
brilliant, and it's very funny, a great whodunit, and I managed to sneak ahead and see some more episodes, and I cannot wait to see whodunit. Because it's brilliant. Nathan Lane pops up in it as well, and I will watch him in anything. He's
just a lot of gorgeous. Old dudes with one young girl.
Yeah, but it's an apartment building in the very expensive part of the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and boy, does it show. You get the context when you watch the program. I want to give you that I watched the first episode of Australian Gangster, and I thought originally that it was a Paulie Fennick piss take. I didn't think it was real drama.
Jesus.
The accents are horrendous. And I can see, if it wasn't for the fact that there were legal dramas around it, I can see why they kept it on the shelf. It's not great. I thought that the first season of SAS, and that's on Seven, I thought that the first season of SAS Australia managed to step carefully around the whole torture porn thing and wrote a review directly in that vein last year. I think that season two, they've just fallen ass backwards into torture porn. It's not great. The jury is still out for me. I want to see a couple more episodes, but I just was not impressed. Two big things that I'm stoked about. I got to preview the first episode of Making It Australia on 10. It kicks off Wednesday this week. It is the best. It just is warm and inviting and welcoming and so much fun. Harley Breen and Susie Youssef are hosts. Absolutely smash it out of the park.
Maybe I'll be wrong.
Well, maybe you will be. Who knows? And maybe it won't rate either. But I'm going to watch every last minute of that program because I think it is excellent television and a great antidote to just feeling like shit being in lockdown. It's super, super good. And again, it's only 10 episodes, so it'll be 5 weeks and it's done. The one that I do want to warn you about that I think is incredible, season 2 of Morning Wars / The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus.
I'm excited.
Wow. It's set at the start of 2020, so pre-pandemic, and the coronavirus is kind of a subplot across the season, but it is coming straight off the back of season 1 for those that have seen it and know the big blow-ups and the fallout from that. It is incredible. I was transfixed. I just had to go next to get through it as quick as I can. It is a weekly drop. So you'll get the first episode this week, the next episode, and so on. I've seen all 10, and I have to keep my mouth shut because holy crap.
I can't wait.
So good. I'm excited. That's Morning Wars Season 2, Apple TV Plus.
Excellent. Thank you, Malky. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of TV Black Box. For more exclusives and insights, go to tvblackbox.com.au and don't forget to sign up for the newsletter by going to tvblackbox.com.au/newsletter. All right, I'm Rob McKnight. I've been joined by David Robinson, Sarah Monahan, Aaron Ryan and Steve Mulk. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.